I'm Howard Bryant, and this is Only a Game. When Washington Capitals winger T.J. Oshie brought the Stanley Cup home to Minnesota in July, he was greeted by an Ojibwe honor song written especially for the occasion. Oshie is one of just a few active NHLers with Native American ancestry. But decades before T.J. Oshie picked up a hockey stick for the first time, Fred Sasakamoose helped pave the way for Indigenous players in the NHL. Aaron Lakoff has the story.
In 1940, Indian agents with the Canadian government came to the Attakakoop Cree Reservation in central Saskatchewan. 6-year-old Fred Sasakamoose and his 8-year-old brother Frank were forcefully taken from their parents and thrown into a truck.
We didn't know what the heck was going on. We didn't know. We're too small.
Fred and about 30 other kids were driven 5 hours south to St. Michael's Indian Residential School in Duck Lake, Saskatchewan.
You just imagine when the kids were taken away from that reserve, the reservation was empty. Just the elders and parents. The kids were all gone.
Between the 1880s and the 1990s, children were removed from Indigenous reserves all over Canada and put into residential schools as part of a national policy of assimilation.
In order to understand what the residential schools were, you have to go back from Canada into the United States.
That's Clifton Ariwaete Nicholas, a Mohawk activist from the Ganasatagi Reserve near Montreal.
The residential schools, as we know it in the modern context, originated in the United States with what they called the industrial schools. It wouldn't teach them anything academic, really, beyond being able to operate whatever machines they would need.
Clifton never went to a residential school, but has many family members who did.
In these schools, they would indoctrinate them into Christianity, kill the Indian, and save the child.
Residential schools were administered by the Canadian government and local churches. At the schools, Indigenous kids were barred from speaking their languages. Thousands were tortured and even killed. Many Indigenous people have described what happened in the residential schools as genocide.
It's almost genius, if it wasn't so evil. How do you destroy a culture? How do you destroy people and keep them down almost permanently? You kill their language, you kill their culture, you remove their maternal lines. There, you're done.
Sexual assault at the hands of priests, teachers, and sometimes older kids was rampant in the schools. Fred himself is a survivor of such abuse.
There was sex abuse in there, a lot of it. The priests and his sisters, well, not going to talk about it.
Some children found cracks of light in the darkness. For Fred, that was hockey. The sport was introduced at St. Michael's in 1944 by Father Georges Roussel, a French-Canadian priest who had just arrived from the hockey-crazed city of Montreal.
He was just like a father, Father Roussel. And he cared. And they come to me and he said, "Freddie, I'm going to make a champion out of you."
Fred thought Father Roussel was a bit crazy. How could he make championship-winning hockey players out of the kids in the residential school? They had no freedom and were confined to the grounds. But it turns out that Father Roussel was right.
We won the provincial midget champion. Still got the sweater. St. Michael's School. Won a little trophy. The best in Saskatchewan. We walked all over them.
Hockey brought Fred joy. But he also remembers feeling sad.
Loneliness. I wanted to go back to my parents. Somebody to hug me, to kiss me.
In 1948, at the age of 15, Fred aged out of the residential school and went back to live with his parents on the reserve. He was happy to be reunited, but it wouldn't last for long.
2 months after, we were working in the field, working for a white man. I think it was $3 a day. One afternoon, we were in the field there. I seen a car. Two people came out. When I recognized Father Roussel, I put my head down and I said, "I ain't going back to school. I'm not going back. I'm home now."
Fred says Father Roussel was with a big man in a long coat. His name was George Vogan. He wanted Fred to come with him, not to the residential school, but to Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to play junior hockey.
I wanted to stay. Fame was nothing. Money was nothing. I want Mom and Dad. Look at Dad, and he said, you go, my son. 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, you come back. I went with George. We traveled for, oh man, 8 hours. Long ways. We got to that place, a little town called Moose Jaw. And I said, that's where I live. He took me home.
Fogan had brought Fred to Moose Jaw to try out for the Canucks, a junior hockey team. But Fred struggled to fit in.
130 kids, the training camp. 130, all white. So I was ashamed. Ashamed of being Indian. I could never change it.
Fred says George and his wife took good care of him. But his heart yearned for home.
Sometimes I cry. You kind of have to excuse me a little bit. I look back to the north, where I come from. It was just like a curtain, black. Everything goes dark. It was like there was nothing there. My life. I left everything behind.
As the days went by, Fred's homesickness got worse.
I was starting to talk to these white kids. Where's that little, my friend that was sitting beside me? Oh, he got sent home, he said. You're not good enough. I said, I'm the one I want to go home. I said, why did they send me home?
Fred had only been in Moose Jaw for 2 weeks, but it was enough. So at 8 in the morning, just after George and his wife had left for work, Fred packed up a bag and snuck away.
North. I knew the direction to go. I start walking. I went 28 miles. A car pulled up, and it was George. He said, where are you going, Freddie? I said, 2 weeks, George. Going home. He looked down, and he had tears coming down his eyes. He begged. He begged. You come back. I'll give you 50 cents a day. With a lot of money, 50 cents at that time, you could buy pop and 2 ice creams. Another 2 weeks, if you don't make it, I'll drive you home. But just give me 2 more weeks, he said.
Fred agreed to return to the Canucks training camp.
I see kids, they were leaving. They were down to 50, down to 35, and I was still there. And I was skating hard. George would lace up my shoes, my skates. He would sit there and he'd just lace them. You know, he wouldn't leave me alone. I made it. I made that team.
So Fred stayed in Moose Jaw.
George Bogan, a white man, who helped me. Every day, he hugged me. Walk me down the street. He hold my hand. You see that rainbow? We'll walk that rainbow together. At the end of that rainbow is pot of gold. You know what that pot of gold is? And he point. It's you.
In 1953, at the end of Fred's fourth and final season of junior hockey eligibility, Fred and the Moose Jaw Canucks lost to the Regina Pats in the playoffs. After the game, Fred's team headed into the dressing room. It was there that Fred would get some news that would change his life.
George walked in. He said, don't take your stuff off. It's an announcement to be made.
George had a telegram in his hand.
All these 24 kids had a vision. They wanted to go to the National League, NHL. When they opened that paper, Fred Sisakamos, report immediately to the Chicago Blackhawks. Wow. The room just went still.
Fred, now 20 years old, would be a pro. So he left Moose Jaw, going even further away from home.
I went to Chicago. Wow. I look at that dressing room of the Chicago Blackhawks. I see number 21. On top of that, number 21, Sisakamos. That's what it was all about.
On November 20th, 1953, Fred played his first game with the Blackhawks.
You step on that ice, you could hear drums just like that. Big Chicago Stadium, three balconies like that.
You played one season in the NHL.
I played 11 games.
11 games. Why did you decide to leave after one season?
I wanted to go home all the time. You are no longer 500 miles away. You are 5,000 miles away. It didn't matter about money, glory. It didn't matter. I didn't want that. I wanted home.
11 games. Not one goal, not even an assist. But with those 11 games, Fred made his mark on hockey history by being one of the first Indigenous people to play in the NHL. Fred was a trailblazer. His legacy lives on today amongst thousands of First Nations hockey fans who saw the Fred Sisakamoose story as an inspiration.
Fred was definitely the bridge builder. Just through his actions gave opportunities.
Urquhart Belyars is an Indigenous writer, radio broadcaster, and lifelong hockey fan living in Montreal.
Fred is like an icon in our communities because our youth, who are dealing with so many issues like suicide and alcoholism and drug abuse and just coming from really, really dark places themselves, and they see this guy become a professional hockey player, it's something that really is very important for our youth, and I really hope that we see more of that.
Of the roughly 700 players in the NHL today, there are fewer than 10 of Indigenous descent. While it's a small group, there are some all-stars among them, including world-class goaltender Carey Price and TJ Oshie of the Stanley Cup-winning Washington Capitals. In 2008, under then-Prime Minister Stephen Harper, the Canadian government issued an official apology for its residential school policy. The gesture was controversial. Many Indigenous people saw the apology as empty words while their rights were still being violated.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Sisakamoose to the Order of Canada.
I was there with Fred as he traveled to Ottawa to receive the Order of Canada last spring for his decades of work lifting up Indigenous youth through hockey programs back home in Attakakoop. And I could see the pride in his eyes as he was handed the medal. I asked him how he felt in his own words.
Oh boy, that was one of the greatest moments I think in life. And it's great.
Fred is 84 now. He lives back home in Attakakoop, Saskatchewan, surrounded by his wife, their kids, and 128 grandkids and great-grandkids. He still loves to settle down in front of the TV to watch hockey games, and he's a lifelong fan of the Blackhawks.
That's reporter Aaron Lakoff. When Billie Jean King defeated Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes in 1973, Janice Stoner was working as a surveyor in the Alaska wilderness. All her co-workers were men.
They're just furious. And they're like going, she cheated. I said, she won. And they stopped. And they circled me. And they started screaming at me.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
What's unique about the human experience? And what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Howard Bryant.
And that's not right. This is not fair. This has happened to me too many times. This is not fair.
That was Serena Williams talking to chair umpire Carlos Ramos during last Saturday's seismic U.S. Open women's final, won convincingly by Naomi Osaka. The championship belonged to a dominant Osaka, but the events of the day, the point penalties, the behavior of Ramos and Williams, the acidic aftermath, and the questions of race, gender, and equal treatment made this more than a tennis match. So instead of three stories you should know, this week we're going to talk about three angles of this one big, complicated story. Joining me today are Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History, Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Penn State University. Welcome to the show, Amira.
Hey.
And Julie DeCaro, sports writer and host at 670 The Score in Chicago via Skype. Welcome back, Julie.
Hi, Howard.
So let's look at the first side of this, which is Serena herself. My first thought when she said, "This has happened to me too many times," was history. I can't remember a great player that gets less dispensation than Serena. This woman and her family have been under constant assault since they came in to the sport 25 years ago. Whether we're talking about the unflattering cartoons, the body shaming, the cat suit attack that started this tournament. And now I looked at this and I said, this feels personal. Amira, I could see why she saw it as personal. What were your thoughts on this?
I teed on that same word choice. This happens to me how many times, again and again. And that's the frustration I felt coming from Serena Williams, especially around accusations of cheating. That's the first thing she bristled at. And it immediately conjured memories of me of Indian Wells, where there's allegations of her father, Richard Williams, fixing the match, this idea that the fix was in. Mm-hmm. And of course, that treatment there, the chorus of boos, racially charged comments and screams towards them led to Serena's 14-year boycott of Indian Wells. So I think that the history certainly had made it feel very personal to Serena. And I also think the reaction also felt deeply personal.
Amira's absolutely right. It goes back to her and Venus making their debut in this sport with their beads and looking different mm-hmm. from everyone else, and the way that they were immediately sort of segregated from everyone else and they were a constant source of attention. I thought, you know, this has got to be just absolutely the last straw for her. And she does such a great job normally of being so stoic in the face of all this stuff. It was really difficult, I think, to watch her struggle for all women, knowing how she feels, and of course, particularly for women of color. And it's hard to say it's not personal, right? When you immediately see the backlash on Twitter, people saying she broke the rules. You see the cartoon that came out of Australia, which depicts her as this hulking, almost Sambo-like character of herself.
With a pacifier on the court.
Absolutely. And with Naomi Osaka as depicted as a slender Caucasian woman, which I don't even know where that came from.
To me, when you have privilege, everything is an isolated incident. When you're Serena and you feel like you don't, nothing is. Let's go to the second side of this, which is the double standard. Here is Serena to the tournament director.
There are men out here that do line marks because I'm a woman. Because I'm a woman, you're going to take this away from me? That is not right.
That was a little hard to hear, but what Serena was saying was that there are men on tour who do a lot worse. Julie, you wrote a great piece about this double standard, and Martina Navratilova wrote another great piece in the New York Times that men acting like jerks shouldn't be the standard. But how tiring does it get, not only to have to navigate this double standard, but to also be told that it doesn't exist?
It is exhausting. And part of the issue in this is that this particular umpire, Carlos Ramos, in the past 2 years has given warnings to Rafael Nadal and to Novak Djokovic for similar issues. And Novak Djokovic said to him, you know, called him out for having different rules for different people. Rafael Nadal said to him, "You will never chair another one of my matches." He didn't punish them for it. But this, for some reason to him, was so untenable that he felt he just couldn't sit there for it. And I think we all know why. Jimmy Connors called a referee an abortion. I mean, we all know what John McEnroe did on the sidelines. And it never led to this kind of conversation and this kind of international debate. So how do you take it as anything other than it being because she's a woman? And there's so many things about her that are constantly criticized and commented on. The way she wears her hair, it's her body looking different than the way they think most women in tennis's body should look. And she always manages to rise above it, and she always seems to say the right thing. And I think that watching her face crumple was so identifiable to so many women, because in the workplace, no matter how badly we're treated, we are always expected to bear it with a smile and with grace. And the idea of a woman just completely losing it on a man who has wronged her is something that is still so foreign and so unacceptable to so many people. And I think we saw that play out, you know, in the conversation that we're having across the country right now.
Now, here's Serena again.
You owe me an apology. Say it. Say you're sorry. Well, then don't talk to me.
You know, as tirades go, that's pretty tame if you watch tennis. But now you even have umpires talking about perhaps discussing a boycott. And Julie, you're right. Players have done this for a long time. But a boycott over this? Amira.
That's where you can see this kind of double standard. Where was that energy for all of these other moments? And I think personally, one of the things I noticed when I watched that is it immediately brought me back to when I was a high school soccer player and was called on a tight call, and another coach was screaming and telling me I was an animal. And the feeling of, like, excuse me, how are you so card happy now when I have watched boys on the varsity team do far worse? So it starts really young, where you start to see the disparity and how tightly the game is called. And I feel such a frustration at, you know, this ability to who can have outbursts, who can get mad, who has the full spectrum of emotions available to them as an athlete and as a person. And so that's one of the things about this situation that really jumped out to me, particularly as a Black woman. I think that immediate feeling that you've transgress the box that you know you have to be in. You've opened the door now for racist cartoons. You've opened the door for the people to construct this image of a brutish, angry Black woman. You've opened the door for everything that you know is going to come. And that's one of the reasons why you always contain yourself. And in that moment of slippage, I think there's such a relief that she did it and she spoke out. And then everything that's come after that almost reinforces the idea that the box is that safe place to be.
Yeah, and this is one of the big fears that I've always had with Serena, is the fetishizing of her power, the fetishizing of her passion, the fetishizing of her aura. Because when it works in your favor, everybody loves it. But when it doesn't, she gets penalized even more harshly. And finally, let's go with the, for me, which was the most important part of this, which was the third part. The Serena, the symbol. You know, it was clear to me also in her post-match press conference that Serena is now viewed and views herself as a symbol. She's a symbol of motherhood. She's a symbol of strength, perseverance, passion, power. Naomi Osaka offered an interesting counter when she said, "When I step on the court, I am only a tennis player." So it made me wonder about the weight of all of this. Is Serena carrying and being asked to carry too much?
Of course she is. I mean, of course she is. She's become a symbol for so many women. Hearing her say to a man, "You owe me an apology, say you're sorry." For so many women, that's such a fantasy to be able to scream that at a man in a workplace who has a position of power over you. "You owe me an apology, tell me you're sorry." We could never do that, but we sort of live vicariously watching Serena do it. And that is unfair to her. I mean, she obviously doesn't speak for all of us, but I mean, I think it's a credit to who she is as a human being that we feel that way about her and that we sort of put our hopes and dreams on her.
She's also profited from this. She has marketed this. I haven't seen anybody market motherhood and power the way she has. There's a moment in time right now where, one, it's profitable for her. People are listening to this. It's something that I don't think that anyone's seen before. And I think one other thing, and Amira, jump in on this, is also that now you also see another shift where people are talking about her not only as the greatest female athlete of all time, but the greatest athlete, period. There is a shift taking place right now.
Certainly. And I think that Serena reminds me very much of this century's Jack Johnson. Her swagger, her unforgivable Blackness, and her sheer dominance in the face of all of these kind of other barriers. And I certainly think about that a lot, because I think sometimes when it happens that we're in this conversation about Serena, is hard to have a nuanced conversation, because we have to figure out if we're talking about Serena the symbol or Serena the person. And sometimes the problem in the politics of being a symbol means that you lose track of the person.
Now, does she get to be a person anymore?
Exactly. Exactly.
And so many times over the past week, Serena was clearly the proxy for what so many people feel daily. They see their struggles through her, and you could feel that projection throughout the week. This was Three Stories You Should Know, the Serena Williams edition. I'd like to thank my guests, Amira Rose Davis, assistant professor at Penn State, and Julie DeCaro, host of The Score 670 in Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Howard.
Forty-five years ago, the stage was being set for an historic tennis match.
Do you like her?
No, I hate her. She's a woman lib leader, and I hate those libbers. I'm an anti-libber, and the leader for all the men around the world who don't like the women pushing them around.
But 2 years before Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King faced off in the famous Battle of the Sexes, 19-year-old Janice Stoner decided to leave her home in Southwest Michigan. She didn't know it at the time, but that tennis match would become a frequent topic of conversation at her new workplace. Here's Janice Stoner in her own words.
Women's lib was entering into my thinking, and it was starting to be in the air. And when I told my parents I was going to go to Alaska, they said, "Well, what are you going to do there?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to get a job." And my dad said, what can you do besides be a prostitute? And I was just shocked. And Alaska was as far away from them as I could get and still be in the United States. If you want to see Alaska and you want to make money, you become a surveyor. But no women were being hired to be surveyors. No, because you were out in tent camps. And a couple of the guys said, well, you know what? They always hire a cook because, you know, we're out there for months at a time. You have to have a cook. So why don't you apply to be a cook? Okay, so I created this application, and on it, it says other jobs you will consider. I just clicked the box surveyor. In August, they sent me a letter, and they said, report for duty on such and such date in Anchorage. Come prepared to leave for work. I got to be a women's libber first in that regard. And I didn't take that lightly. I considered that a very big responsibility that I had to help other women get into the field. If I blew it, nobody else ever got to get in. You just got to show them you can work as hard as everybody else. And in the morning, when we would put out the equipment, you know, we always were sharpening chainsaws and the axes and the machetes. And we'd lay it out every morning. Every single time, somebody was carrying something lighter than me. Every single time. That was just what I had to do to make sure that they could never, ever say I wasn't pulling my weight. Yeah, I was almost murdered by these guys. Oh, yeah. I was on another job. We're near Dillingham, 30 miles out of Dillingham. So, you know, there's no radio. There's a little bit of communication with the world, but not much. And it was the summer that Billie Jean King was playing Bobby Riggs in the tennis match. And for the days or weeks before this was going to happen, every meal when we would have dinner at the dining hall chow tent, oh, that woman, she's not going to win. It was just vile. He's going to whip her. It was just, you know, really, all I could do right now is talk to you in swear words. I mean, so I won't. But you could get the flavor of it. It was just, they just hated her. And so I didn't say a word. I had learned very early, you just shut up. You just shut up. Then the event happened, and she won. And she won. And I was like, thank you, Jesus. I was just beside myself. After all those weeks of listening to these guys dig themselves into this hole, and they were wrong, I just was like gloating. I was gloating. So we're walking out to the job. And we've been walking for hours. We're way out there. And they're furious. They're just furious. And they're like going, she cheated. She did blah, blah, blah. I said, she won. And everything they said, all I said was, she won. I had never said a word about this before. And they were just saying every excuse there was to say why it happened. She won. And they stopped. And they circled me. And they started screaming at me. You took my friend's job. You shouldn't be here. Now, I had worked, this was many months into my job there. They'd work with me every day for months. You shouldn't be here. You can't do this job. Why do you think you're here? And they were just screaming at me. And I'm screaming back. I'm answering them back. What do you mean I don't need a job? Why don't I need a job? Why don't I need a job? Why does your friend need a job better than me? Well, you should be married. I'm not married. I need a job. I was 30 miles from the nearest town. I hadn't seen another white woman in 6 weeks. I had been stuck with these guys for all these months. It wasn't like I could just go home and talk to my girlfriends. I was there with these dudes. That's all I was, where I was. And then all of a sudden, it was a moment of clarity. And I looked around and I realized every one of these men has a fatal, deadly weapon. They have a machete, and we sharpen them every morning. They have axes, double-headed axes. They have chainsaws. One swipe and my head is off. Off. I'm dead. I'm friggin' dead. And all they have to do is pick up the Tundra, stick me underneath it, because you can pick it up with your hands, stick me under it, put that Tundra down, work for the entire day, walk out another route, and all they had to do was say, a bear must have got her, and they never, ever would have found my body. Ever. Ever, ever, ever. End of story. And I just shut my mouth. I just shut my mouth, and they kept screaming at me. And very soon, when someone's not answering anymore, the steam starts to simmer down, and they picked up their weapons, put them on their shoulders, and silently went back out on the trail. And Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs was never, ever mentioned again.
That was Janice Stoner, in her own words. Janice worked as a surveyor in Alaska for a total of 6 years. She now works as a project manager in the San Francisco Bay Area. That story was produced by Jared Sport and Jerome Nelson. Subscribe to Only a Game on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, please take a minute to leave us a review. They're like breadcrumbs. They help other listeners find the show. As the school year starts up again, so does the annual search for volunteer coaches, referees, and carpool drivers. Commentator Alyssa Eli has the story of one such volunteer.
Almost every volleyball coach for the travel team is young and has personal skin in the game. One is a setter's mother, another a libero's uncle, whose arm had been twisted only slightly into service. The girls are 11 and 12 years old, and they can't reliably aim the ball yet. Those glamorous beach volleyball heroines they watched on TV never mentioned the hundreds of hours of drills in a sweaty gym with nothing more than a chocolate popsicle at the end. This is not the same bikini world. Almost every coach is young, except for one assistant. He's white-haired and wears the team shirt a little tightly around the waist. Sometimes he limps, chasing wild balls. He's early for every practice and has never missed an away game, no matter how dreary the interstate commute or winter weather. Probably most girls on the team don't know he has a daughter and that she played volleyball herself 10 years ago. They certainly wouldn't know she loved it so much her high school boyfriend inked his prom invitation on her ball. They might or might not care to hear she was once a captain, and that setting the ball in beautiful arcs was her great joy. And his. He was a father then, not an assistant coach. Up and down the East Coast, he drove to every game, sat on every bench, and sometimes left the building to gather himself when he disagreed with the referee. He didn't approve when coaches favored their best players, and he makes sure these girls play equally now. You wonder what the players on the travel team make of this older man with white hair and endangered joints. He comes home after practice, takes a non-steroidal, wraps a bag of frozen mangoes or peas around his knee, and opens his book to the page where he's been reading about best coaching practices and positive techniques for motivating young players. His daughter is far off, on the opposite side of the country. Maybe she'll come back someday, maybe she won't. But he's still in it with her.
Alyssa Eli is a community psychiatrist in Massachusetts. About a decade ago, when the Atlanta Braves were hiring a new stadium organist, they took their top candidate to spring training and asked him to come up with walk-up songs to throw off opposing batters.
I think they wanted to test to see if I would really kind of fall on my face, if I would, I guess, collapse under the pressure.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
I'm Howard Bryant. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of the Chicago Sting's trailblazing 1978 soccer friendly in Cuba. But now, this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Charlie?
Hey, Howard.
Did you know Serena Williams made some news last week?
It's unbelievable. I lost it in the coverage of all the other stuff in sports, but I hear there was a little noise made, as they say. I think what's been done to Serena Williams in the aftermath by people who have obviously been waiting for an opportunity to do these things to Serena Williams over the last 5 or 6 years has been disgusting.
Question for you, though, on this is, do you think the sport hurt itself 40 years ago? I mean, were we paying for this by enabling the entire tennis bad boy image in the first place? Because now that's been embedded in the sport as cool, unless Serena does it.
It certainly didn't hurt itself at the time. I mean, yeah. It was never more popular. At that time, you also had Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova bringing the women's game to a height it had never known. It was a very big time for tennis, both men and women. So I don't think it hurt itself at the time. Are we seeing the lingering effects of it? You know, I don't know. Tennis players have been so coddled for most of their lives that the idea that we've raised a generation of unpleasant brats in a lot of ways, not saying that Serena's one, but petulant, entitled behavior is now part of the deal.
It kind of comes with the territory.
Yeah.
So when the NFL season started, the three projected worst teams, of course, were in the Patriots division, right? You had the Jets, you had the Dolphins and the Bills. But, Charlie, after a very nice win on Monday Night Football, are people rightfully getting excited about the J-E-T-S, Jets, 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 or was it Lions gonna Lions?
Well, I was gonna say, Matt Patricia's debut was awful. The Jets were good. The Jets looked competitive. The Jets looked like they could at least give the Patriots a game for a half.
And, well, that's a high bar.
I mean, you score 48 points against any NFL team, and you're playing very well.
Jacksonville Jaguars defensive back Jalen Ramsey has been leveling very public criticism of NFL players. But last week, he said he could crack an NHL roster and could do it within 6 months. And the NFL players are a little hacked off about that.
Yeah, I know. But I'll tell you what. I will put up one entire American dollar to Jalen Ramsey if he tries out for an NHL team in 6 months. He can try out for the Saginaw Gears, and I'll still pay him the dollar.
Point of information, he doesn't know how to ice skate.
See, that's a problem. You know, every hockey coach I've talked to has said that not being able to skate will drop your draft position. Really.
Yeah, we don't want to curb your ambition, but it's kind of a prerequisite,
yes,
isn't it?
That's exactly right.
It comes with the job territory. So we have a new WNBA champion. It is the Seattle Storm. They don't have an NBA team over there, but they've got Breanna Stewart, and they've got a championship. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, Breanna Stewart is going to have to build a new trophy case because things are starting to pile up on her. She won 4 NCAA championships. It took a couple of years to win her first WNBA championship. Natasha Howard had a terrific game. Breanna Stewart's going to become the face of that league, I have a feeling.
Yeah, and also an MVP on top of that as well. And what I like about this, too, is that this was the first year for me where, and I don't know if it was a byproduct of social media or just the fact that the game is starting to grow and people are talking about it more, or the Neanderthals are going away or whatever it is, but people were really excited about this. I like that the NBA players are coming out saying, hey, watch this sport. It's worth watching. And they balled out. It was a pretty good
season. I made note of this during the NCAA women's tournament this year. The level of play in women's basketball has been a rocket to the moon over the last 3 years. I don't know whether it's the second generation of Title IX coming of age or what it is. The caliber of play is really high right now. It's high in college and it's high in the pros. And as you said, I think the involvement of, you know, the NBA players who have shown themselves to be socially enlightened in a number of different ways is really remarkable. And I congratulate them for that.
Yeah. So while we're talking basketball, Davidson defeated Guilford 91-61 on Thursday, but that's a football score.
Yeah, Davidson managed to give up 61 points and win by 30. If you're the coach looking at the game films, I think you burn them. Yeah, because I don't think you can learn anything from a game like this.
No, and it's all cute and everything, but let's just put something on the table. I hate college football.
You do.
And I hate college football for this reason, because I don't understand a sport where you can have so many games during the season where these games don't matter, where you go out and you score 91 points on a football field, or Miami goes out and they win 77-0, or Alabama's out there winning, they scored 80 points in a football game. How many games during the season where you're not even an underdog, never mind having a chance to lose the game? I think Alabama goes 2 or 3 seasons before they're an underdog at home. When was the last time Alabama was an underdog at home?
Well, Alabama's just good, but it's all about the check. You know that.
Well, exactly.
It's all about the Division III teams getting a big payday for going out and getting stomped. You know, I myself think it's kind of, you know, athletic malpractice for the athletic departments of the smaller schools to do this just for the dough, but they need the dough.
And finally, Charlie, like real golf, disc golf is a sport in which you have to watch out for the obstacles. But recently, Alaskan disc golfer Kelly Williamson encountered one that was potentially dangerous. What was it?
Apparently, these people play this sport out in the woods. It was a black bear, and he had to throw the he had to throw the disc over a black bear. Meanwhile, in Florida, a guy named Richard Peel was playing disc golf in a park in Clearwater, and he was trying to get his disc from a pond, and an alligator bit him. I mean, I don't mean to be cruel, but the black bear lives and does other things in the woods. The alligator lives in the pond. You're trespassing on them with your silly disc sport. I mean, every year when the golf tour goes through Florida, there's always that picture of that giant prehistoric reptilian beast in the pond.
On 17, just sitting right there sunning himself, right?
That's right. Don't underclub yourself, pal, or your lunch.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Howard.
Okay, so everyone knows that in baseball, the players on the home team get to pick their walk-up song. Maybe it's a nod to their heritage or an ode to Taylor Swift. Often, it's a clue to their musical taste. Walking up to bat or coming out of the bullpen, the music is designed to give the player some swagger. But if you're a visiting player, you don't get to choose your walk-up song. And if you're a visiting batter at the Atlanta Braves home field, say the Marlins' Yadier Rivera, you might hear something like this. Reporter Maya Croth has the story.
Swing and a drive. No. First pitch. No. He has done it again.
Oh, my gosh. It's a hot Tuesday night, and the crowd at Atlanta's SunTrust Park is pumped. Rookie Ronald Acuna Jr. has just homered for the fifth time in six games, giving the division-leading Braves an early lead over the last-place Miami Marlins. But fans aren't too comfortable. The Marlins' go-ahead run strides toward the plate. It's shortstop J.T. Riddle. The Jumbotron camera trains its lens on home plate. But me, I'm focused on the organ player. Matthew Kaminsky is the man behind the organ. He's known in baseball for his subtle ribbing of opposing players. His almost 13,000 Twitter fans track his every move.
Yep, I'm ready to get one. Braves organist played the old Batman theme when J.T. Riddle stepped up to bat. LMAO.
It all started when the Braves hired Kaminsky, a professional jazz organist and organ teacher, almost 10 years ago.
They were searching for an organist, and one of my adult organ students knew the guy who was searching. And they got me an interview really quick, and what I did was I just recorded myself at home playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. I played all the songs that I thought that a sporting event would need. And they called me in for an interview, and they said that we want you to come up with songs that pertain to the opposing player as they walk up. The example he used was David Ortiz, Big Poppy. So they said Popeye the Sailor Man for Big Poppy.
Kaminsky thought, okay, easy. I can do that. The Braves tested him out at spring training, where lineups are much less predictable. If a normal game requires coming up with songs for nine batters, a spring training game might have 20 or 30.
I think they want to test to see if I would really kind of fall on my face, if I would, I guess, collapse under the pressure.
He was nervous, but unfazed.
When I kind of got the aha moment was playing a Twisted Sister song. So Twisted Sister on the organ is not usually what you think about. But I played You're Not Gonna Take It for a guy named Dee. You know, Dee Snider is the singer for Twisted Sister. So when I played that, back then I was on a headset so I could hear my director and my boss talking to me while I played. And they kind of bust out laughing because they couldn't believe that I was playing Twisted Sister. So when I made Twisted Sister work on the organ, I said, okay, I think I could do this.
At first, it was just Kaminsky and his wife coming up with the ideas for songs to play before each homestand. But now, he could almost get by just using suggestions from fans on Twitter. As I sit next to him in the booth this Tuesday night, I watch him scroll through his mentions on the iPad that sits next to the organ.
Someone has requested, "Who are you?" They requested for Yadiel Rivera, but I'm not too sure why. Maybe because he's a rookie, yeah. No one knows who he is. Some people get really kind of dark with their humor. I don't go there. There's certain things that I think are harmless. It's usually pretty tame what I go after.
What is fair game? Besides riffing on names, Kaminsky's musical selections wink at anything from a player's dating history to his haircut. He played You're Cheatin' Heart after Ryan Braun admitted using performance-enhancing drugs. Kaminsky watches the player's reactions on a monitor.
If they're smiling or laughing, I almost always think they're laughing at me. You never know what they're thinking. But there was a couple times where you could really tell that what I was playing was making them laugh. Like Matt Kemp, he lost a whole bunch of weight after he left Atlanta and went to the Dodgers. So I played Half the Man You Used to Be. It's a Stone Temple Pilots song. So I played that as well as a Rihanna song because he used to date Rihanna. I saw him smiling quite a bit every time I would try something.
Through these walk-up songs, Kaminsky has felt connected to players that he's never actually met.
I see them from afar, so I kind of never know what they're like in person, so I don't mean to cause them any harm. I think that's what home field advantage is all about.
In the third inning, Marlins second baseman Starlin Castro comes up to bat. So, naturally, Kaminsky plays. Twitter loves it. Someone tweets to ask if an opposing player has ever requested a song.
And the answer is no.
Would you play it if they did?
No. Why would I want to play a song they want? Some people ask me why I don't play different songs for every time they come up to bat. And I think it's more irritating for them to hear the same song sometimes. I'm usually sick of the songs too. So after, you know, 12 or 13 times of playing the same songs, but you know, I think sometimes it's a lot more effective for me to just to keep on burning that song into that player.
Just don't call him the trolling organist.
I don't know if I like that word. That's what everyone uses. I'd rather use the word entertaining organist. People say it's almost a game within a game. And I think that's a really cool thing that I could be interactive. To me, it's just to make everything more fun.
That story was from reporter Maya Croft. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm Howard Bryant. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.